Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show featuring the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. I'm your host for the day, Greta Anderson, and I'm really excited for today's show. We've got song and dance, we've got a protester lockdown on Grinnell College campus, and we have a surprise presentation of an award to a local conservationist. But first, we've got, as always, meteorologist Elwyn Taylor with correspondent Vaughn Kettleson for the start of our week.
Community Radio, KHOI. I'm Vaughn Kettleson talking weather here with ISU Extension climatologist Dr. Elwyn Taylor. And boy, Elwyn, this past weekend felt like there was a hint of spring in the air. We're past Groundhog's Day. Is this milder weather a sign of maybe early spring?
Well, you know, people on Saturday started looking at temperatures in the 40s and thinking, okay, winter's over, don't think that. But it might be over even for 2 weeks. Well, it won't be over come Wednesday morning when it's 9 degrees outside, but that will be a brief bitter spell of, as a small storm goes by, though it looks small right now at least, and that will go by and head for Maine, and we'll get a flow of air from the Gulf of Mexico. It will be warm. It will be not too wet, but maybe there'll be some fog. We can't tell yet. Nevertheless, warmer than usual temperatures for, well, out to the middle of the month. So then that doesn't get us past the cold weather possibilities, but it does make you feel good. And I don't think it'll make the lawns green just yet, but the ones that didn't completely go dormant will green up a little bit. It's not a mild winter. It's just has mild weeks, and I think this is going to be one of them, at least after Wednesday.
Okay, well, still February here in Iowa, and still winter, that's for sure. ISU Extension climatologist Dr. Elwyn Taylor joining us. I'm Vaughn Kettleson on KHOI Community Radio.
All right, warmer weather this week. And now we have a story you folks are going to love. A little surprise party that happened right here in KHOI Studios Friday morning. Our wildlife correspondent, Pat Schlarbaum, was there to conduct the show with three guys who like nothing better than to go fishing. Do you have any idea why Ada Hayden might be the only lake in Iowa where trout can reproduce? Keep listening to find out and to hear the nature of the surprise I just referred to.
Well, this morning we're joined with Hank Kohler, Air Ames Citizen of the Natural World, with Jeff Kapaska, a fisheries biologist with the Department of Natural Resources. And Michael Metz is here. We'll be talking about some of the Story County Conservation Alliance work, good work that you do towards the end. But welcome to Local Talk. And Jeff, we're going to be talking about the urban trout stocking program up here at Ada Hayden. So why trout at Ada Hayden?
We've got a fantastic trout fishery here in Iowa, up in our northeast Iowa streams, and that's become more and more popular. And to help sustain that, you know, we have some hatcheries up in northeast Iowa where we grow trout. Historically, we stocked some trout in urban areas in northeast Iowa, like Mason City, Cedar Falls, Dubuque, and we had a few extra trout maybe a decade ago or so, and we decided, hey, why don't we try and get this popular pastime in northeast Iowa spread out to different parts of the state. So about 2004, we started stocking in Banner Lake down south of Des Moines, and then we've expanded that, and one of the places we've expanded is here at Ada Hayden in Ames. It's because the city invested so well in that park. There's a wonderful parking lot. There's all kinds of great amenities for families, kids, stuff like that. And that's the kind of place we want to bring the trout so we can get people out there and catch them.
Oh, there you go. You've got a destination, and you've got a lot of willing people.
Absolutely.
Now, there is a trout stamp required.
That's correct.
So beyond your fishing license, I just thought I'd throw that in there. Just
12 bucks for the trout stamp. And and with that, you can keep 5 trout a day. And
worth
it's good all year.
Worth every penny of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, worth every penny of the $12. I understand there's also some trout reproduction occurring in the northeast Iowa.
Absolutely.
Stream. So these will not be reproducing here at Ada Hayden.
We don't think so, but Ada Hayden, I think, is the only urban lake, the only place where we're putting fish during the cold weather that they're actually surviving through the summer. So we could potentially grow the state record trout in Ada Hayden someday. You just never know.
Oh, okay.
It's a pretty deep body of water.
It is very deep. It's well oxygenated. It stays cool in the summer, so the trout are over-summering here.
Yeah. Well, fantastic. In the project itself, I understand you were pretty instrumental in even saving that Ada Hayden for...
I went and talked to the city council a few times and was pushing some buttons, just trying to make sure that we had a great place for people to recreate, not necessarily, you know, just a select few.
Did you even think about the trout back in that
maybe
early
not
stages?
Then, but shortly thereafter, with some places deep and as cool as Ada Hayden and with some of the studies that were done with the groundwater influx, I thought for a long time that we could maybe have a special thing out there with the trout. And I pushed really hard for us to try it, and it's worked great.
You mentioned the temperature. What is the temperature range that we like to think of the trout?
You know, trout's optimal temperatures are 70 degrees or less. And so if you get too much warmer than that, they're not going to survive. And so down around the thermocline, where the temperature radically changes from cool to warm in a lake, that stays about that or cooler in the 60s during the summer here at Ada Hayden. So that's why we're seeing the trout hang
out. So this is put and take.
Yep.
But yet the trout fishery in itself here in Iowa has really evolved into natural reproduction. You want to touch on that just a little bit?
You bet. You know, historically, we only had maybe a dozen or so streams in the 1970s or 80s that we had natural reproduction of trout, and that's quadrupled in the interim. Things like the CRP program put
the Conservation Reserve program.
Yep, in the 1980s and 90s put a lot of land back into permanent vegetation, and that allows the water to go in slower and infiltrate through the groundwater. It stays cooler then because the groundwater stays around 50 degrees versus water that runs off maybe 70 or 80 degrees into the streams. And with all that extra groundwater in those streams, they cooled down. Some vegetation grew over top to keep them cool, and they cleaned up, you know, not as much sediment. And with those factors coming together, those streams are now naturally reproducing instead of us having to grow all those fish in the hatchery. And that's one of the reasons why we have the extra fish to stock at a place like Ada Hayden.
Well, there it is.
Yep.
Yeah, so it's gone full circle. And so why is fishing important?
Well, fishing historically is one of the great things that we've seen through history. It's a pastime that's been handed down from generation to generation. There are relics of the Native Americans here in Iowa where they would round up the fish and you know, consume the fish. And it's been a natural staple of people's diets for eons. And I got to thank my buddy Hank here with me. He's one of the guys that really helped me learn how to fish better. He's an expert.
Fantastic. Yeah.
And that's why we're here, because he is one of the most dedicated fishermen in the city of Ames, one of the best fishermen. And the great thing about him is he loves to teach kids how to fish, and he's taught me a lot. And, you know, like with this trout stocking that we're doing next week at Ada Hayden, had we been able to do the event, Hank would have been out there with all of his equipment and stuff and just providing a place and an opportunity and some instruction for people to learn how to catch these fish that we put out there.
And we're listening to Jeff Kapaska with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources here with Hank Kohler. And Hank, you're a citizen of Ames, and this is kind of fits right into your backyard, so to speak. With
I've fished all my life. Grew up on a family farm in northwest Iowa, and you know, my dad would always take us fishing every Sunday. We'd go to one of the local streams. I've probably fell in every river in northwest Iowa during my youth.
What county was that?
We were in Plymouth County, but we'd go up to Sioux County and Lyon County and fish like the Rock River, the Little Sioux River, and Mill Creek, whatever was around there, the Floyd, the Big Sioux.
So do you remember going out on the Rock River when you were pretty young?
Absolutely. And, of course, back then we were just targeting either either channel catfish, which we didn't catch very often, or carp, which we're pretty good at because my mom had these magical dough balls that she'd make. But I always thought that the further I got out on this dead limb, that that one little spot might be just where the big one lay. And sometimes I'd get the big one, and sometimes I'd be grabbing onto the limb as I fell in. One thing I'd like to say about this trout stocking that Jeff talks about is why do they do it in these urban areas? Well, it's because it's always been thought of as an elegant, elusive fish. You know, people have tried to catch it by fly fishing that for generations in the quiet pool and the little stream.
Good point.
But the bottom line is those trout will eat almost anything. So when you get them in a contained area like Ada Hayden, you can take kids out there and fish with little minnows, with pieces of Velveeta cheese, with pieces of night crawlers, with prepared trout bait, whatever. And you can catch trout, and it's pretty special.
Canned corn is a great idea.
You bet. And then you can take it home and eat it if the trout don't eat it.
Yeah.
The Velveeta, too.
Yeah.
You mentioned there's been a rescheduling. When are the trout going to arrive at Ada Hayden?
So I can guarantee they will be here between the 6th and the 8th. It kind of depends on the weather. The trout are coming from Decorah, so there's potential for some bad weather, maybe Tuesday or Wednesday. If the weather holds out and it's good, then the trout will come one of those 2 days. If it's bad weather, then they'll come on Thursday once things, the weather and the roads clear up.
Okay. Well, we'll try to give people a heads up on
you
that.
You bet.
Well, Hank, you've exhibited quite a bit of environmental awareness, among other things. Why do you feel like fishing and the environment is important?
Well, I had a guy a lot smarter than me years ago say that if we didn't teach the younger people or get them out to experience and enjoy nature and wild areas and wild activities, then they, when they become our decision makers, why would they want to protect those areas? You know, if they've never experienced, never seen a special place, why would they want to keep it that special? So I think it's kind of important to talk to people of all ages, but especially the kids. Get them away from the video screens for a day or two. Get them outside, float a river with them, or catch a couple of fish. See what kind of birds they can see. Catch a frog, you know, just get them outside. They really enjoy it, but they have to be exposed to it.
Do you mind if I ask you what you do other than go fishing?
I'm the poster child for naps and fishing. But on a part-time basis, I do some driving for a local company. I also have an LLC called Learn to Fish where I will take people fishing. I don't make a lot of money doing it, but it's fun to do. And about every other week, I go on an adventure someplace. I'll be leaving later today to start an adventure of ice fishing up on Lake Winnipeg for 5 days. So should have some stories to tell when I come back from that one. Yeah.
Well, let's weave in Mike Metz here, a local conservationist with the Ikes and a lot of different organizations.
I guess. One thing, we're talking about fishing today, and a lot of folks don't realize that the Isaac Walton League is named after Isaac Walton, who wrote a publication back, I believe, in the 1600s or thereabouts called The Complete Angler. And so this is great. The Isaac Walton League is one of the oldest conservation groups in the nation, and soil, water, land, and animals are a big interest for Isaac Walton League. And they've been on the forefront for water quality issues. They helped out with some of the trout work that Jeff was talking about earlier, some of the other fishing things going on. We're not only a fishing group, we're a hunting group and a conservation advocate for the state. I'm actually here because I represent not only the Isaac Walton League and Story County Conservation, I'm the current chair of the Olaf Smedahl Conservation Award.
And he was a Ames Tribune reporter.
Right. He worked, I believe, for the Tribune for 23 years, and he had an outdoor page called Outdoors with Ole. And he was a charter member of the Ames chapter of the Isaac Walton League. And the group, along with Story County, the nomination committee is made up of representatives of both groups. And we're here today to recognize Hank Kohler as the 2016 recipient of the award.
Well, that's a surprise.
And I can see by the look on his eye.
I didn't see this
and
coming.
And the twinkle in Jeff's eye that he didn't see this coming at all.
Thank you very much.
And we're, he's remarkable in the things he's done, and it's not only for fishing but conservation in general. He has that Alda Leopold ethic that we're part of the land, and the land is the thing that we're trying to protect here.
Thank you, Mike. And that is awesome. Very special.
In that, yeah.
I'm speechless almost. Not really. If I could add something, because you started talking about Isaac Walton and that, I was going to say, you know, you could take your kids out there to Ada Hayden fishing, and it's fairly easy to catch them, especially shortly after they're stocked. But in fishing, you never know for sure. There's no guarantees. You can be in the right place and do the right thing, and it may not work. It was Isaac Walton that years ago said that the joy in fishing, it is an attempt to capture an elusive yet obtainable prey, therefore creating endless sensations of hope. And that's what fishing is about, because you can never have constant success, and you may have long times of failure, but you always have hope.
It's just getting outdoors that really is the draw, I think.
Yeah.
And that's the reason we call it fishing and not catching.
Okay. Real quick story that happened on Ada Hayden 3 days ago. My nephew James was out there fishing with his dad, and they caught a nice trout, and they decided they're going to keep it, so they just put it on the ice. Well, an immature bald eagle landed about 40 yards away, eyeing that trout. And they just sat there quiet, and the trout would flip a little bit, and that eagle actually hopped and hopped and hopped closer and closer and closer until finally James went and picked the trout up and brought it back. He says, if I'd have thrown it 10 feet away, says he'd have taken it. And that's right here in Ames,
Iowa. Yeah. Well, congratulations, Hank Kohler.
Thank you very much.
This is really kind of very special.
I feel very humbled.
Yeah, thank you, Jeff Kapaska. We're here with Hank Kohler, Ames citizen, Jeff Kapaska with the Department of Natural Resources, and Mike Metz, who just made a very prestigious award to Mr. Kohler.
What Hank is receiving here is a plaque with his name on it, and it actually has some script discussing the award and a little bit about Ollie. And this will... be hung up or displayed at wherever he wants to, but at Story County Conservation at the McFarland offices in the conference room, there is a plaque just like this, and there's plaques next to it with all the recipients who have received this award. So this has been going on now for about 25 years or so, Hank, and so there are a few folks in this room that have actually won the award as well, and you're right up there with some folks that I kind of wonder sometimes. They're the leaders in conservation for Central Iowa. Let's put it that way.
Like I said, I feel very humbled to be in that group because there's some very special people there.
Yeah. You're welcome.
Yeah.
Now let's all go catch some fish.
Okay.
That sounds great.
Well, you heard it first on KHOI. Or if you didn't hear it first, if you read it in the Ames Tribune, you can be sure that Hank Kohler, recipient of the Olaf Smeadal Conservation Award, heard it first at KHOI station Friday morning when this segment was recorded. Many thanks to Pat Schlarbaum for bringing together this crew and, as always, bringing the natural world to our radios. Just to repeat those words of Isaac Walton that Hank quoted, "The joy in fishing is an attempt to capture an elusive yet obtainable prey, therefore creating endless sensations of hope. And don't we all need some of that?" Fishing is not the only recreation going on at Ada Hayden. These days there is skating and hockey going on at the shallow end by the parking lot. And these warmer days of winter are a great time to get out for a walk and see the geese flying off in formations, so close you can hear the sound of their feathers against the air and see their throats move as they honk. If you prefer experiencing nature indoors this time of year, there's always Ryman Gardens. And on Thursday of this week, over the noon hour, there will be a brown bag discussion of a new photography exhibit up at Ryman Gardens called River Stories, Views from an Iowa Watershed. Six women landowners from the Skunk River and Raccoon River watershed took photos on their land and collaborated in captioning the works. Here, Boone County naturalist Danielle Worth discussed this project of the Women Food and Agriculture Network on Thursday from noon to 1. We'll have a link on our KHOI webpage when this show is posted. We turn from bodies of waters to things that threaten those bodies of water, like pipelines and an ongoing struggle at Grinnell College, spurred by President Trump's executive order allowing construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline on historic Lakota lands in North Dakota, the students have doubled down and intensified their campaign. This Saturday, KHOI received a phone call connecting us with five students who had been occupying the admin building on Grinnell's campus since Friday afternoon. Station manager Ursula Rudenberg was here to receive the call, and she broke in to regular programming to interview Ross, one of the student leaders, live on the air.
Tell us, why are you there?
This is a part of a 3-year ongoing campaign to get our college to fully divest from fossil fuels. So our college has a huge endowment. We have about a $2 billion endowment. And in that endowment, we have about $126 million invested in the fossil fuel industry. So for the past 3 years, students at Grinnell, we have a base about 200 students, have been demanding that our college divest its endowment from the fossil fuel industry so that we can stop the effects of climate change and certainly not sponsor them. So the college has refused to divest in the past. We've had meetings, we've had marches, we've had rallies. And we received continued no's from both our president and our board of trustees. So we decided it was time to escalate. With the trustees on campus this weekend, we took 150 students into the administration building from 3:30 to 5 o'clock, shutting down business in this building. And at 5 o'clock, we had five students sit-in who were prepared to be arrested and are now conducting a sit-in until Monday morning at 8 a.m.
In the course of the interview, Ursula asked Ross about his personal motivations for conducting this action and facing the possibility of arrest.
We're all willing to risk arrest for this campaign, and we're working to build out a large coalition of students to really put their bodies on the front line for this campaign to, again, demonstrate to President Kingston how important we think this issue is, and hopefully push him to put the same level of importance on climate change as we do, and to be willing to do whatever's necessary to stop the effects that are coming into Iowa with pipelines ripping through our communities and violating property rights and having corporations use eminent domain to get the government to basically be their private army to come in and kick farmers off their land just so corporations can make more profit. I mean, I'm a young adult, right? I'm 19 years old. This is the world I'll be growing up in. If you think of Bangladesh, for example, Bangladesh is incredibly susceptible to the effects of climate change. With the coast rising, it's forcing people off their lands and it is people off their homes. And at the time that the most vulnerable members of our international community are dying from climate change, are going hungry from climate change, we see corporations just becoming richer and richer every day, profiting off of the destruction of our people and our world. And, I mean, I grew up in a single-income home where I felt the effects of income inequality. And I grew up in a world where I saw everybody around me having individual pain that I could clearly trace back to some of the richest members of our world not caring about anybody but themselves. And I think climate change is the epitome of a privileged, very wealthy elite putting their wants over the vast majority's needs. So I'm sick and tired of seeing that happen in my community. And I think what we're seeing right now is a world that's at a political decision-making point. We see really xenophobic, nationalist, pro-corporate takeover politicians in the United States with Donald Trump, in France, Marine Le Pen, who is basically just the female French version of Donald Trump running for president. She announced her candidacy today. We see xenophobe, nationalist, populists popping up across Europe. And, I mean, this is a direct result of massive global income inequality and a large amount of people who are really mad about the status quo and know we need change. But the choice we have to make is whether we're going to go to a more global, equitable system of populism, where we make the corporations that have profited off of massive exploitation of people across this world pay for the development it would take for everybody, no matter what country they're born in, to have access to basic human rights. Or we're going to see countries continue to close their borders and continue to increase xenophobic policies and give corporations more power. And, I mean, that's just going to become survival of the most privileged and survival of the most powerful. And I think that's an incredibly scary world. I think about my niece a lot, who's an 8-year-old girl growing up. Mm-hmm. And when I hear the remarks Donald Trump say, backed up by policies that are going to continue to hurt the most disadvantaged in our society, it makes me really emotional to think about the consequences that this next generation of women, of people of color, could be facing.
And that was the voice of a student identifying himself as Ross, a Grinnell student who is on the phone with us now, who spent the weekend in the administration building with his 4 cohorts. To review what we just heard, Ross, and what you've told Ursula on Saturday, you're there in the admin building. You've been locked down there all weekend, starting Friday afternoon. Meanwhile, the college board of trustees were meeting, and presumably it was they who were sending college president Raynard Kington over to you several times to negotiate. And now, as you prepare to leave, you feel that you have moved the ball forward with this effort, this escalation of this ongoing 3-year protest.
Definitely. I think so. One thing I would say is I think President Kington was coming on his own accord. Right.
Okay.
Now we're demanding his endorsement to the Board of Trustees because we have a huge coalition of supporters for this campaign. On campus, we have unanimous support of our student government. We have a large number of professors who support our campaign. And so this current stage of our campaign is to urge President Kington to join this coalition of support.
Okay, so the trustee got a taste of what President Kington is facing from the student body and faculty with this demonstration.
Yeah, so my understanding that they had somewhat of an emergency presentation in regards to the protest, where they were filled in on the fact that students were sitting in at the administrative building. And it sounds like they had some questions that some other members of our organization were able to answer and fill them in on why this was happening.
So what did the president say, President Kington, say to you when you met over the weekend?
Yeah, so we think there's going to be a development in negotiations around divestment coming later this week. We have to wait to see what the press release says that he comes out with in regards to that, but we're excited to hear what he has to say in regards to negotiations and concessions about potentially partial fossil fuel divestment. And then a lot of it was not able to escape really the dynamic of him being the president of the college and us being students of the college. And ultimately, I think that in a sense is a fairly intimate dynamic. I mean, Grinnell College has been my dream school since middle school, and I've looked up to President Kington for a while now. And so it's a tense moment. I mean, it's a clash of worldviews. I think President Kington certainly says, at least, that he acknowledges climate change is real. But we, the students I'm sitting in with and the larger base of student action at Grinnell, we are really pained and angered by his refusal to take action if he acknowledges the crisis of climate change. It's only getting worse, and the only way to stop it from getting worse is to take action. So a lot of it was debating back and forth about where the line is, when we feel moved to act in this moment, and us telling him, hey, the moment's now to act. If you don't act now, there'll never be a chance to reverse it. And him saying, well, I don't know if that's true. We think the science proves that it's true. I mean, he was a former scientist before he got into academia, so we certainly know that he knows that it's true. And right now what we're waiting for him to do is to have the bravery and the courage to take the risk.
But you're, in a way, you are providding him the courage by your actions.
That's what we're hoping to do.
Backing him up. This has happened at other colleges, right? The divestment.
Yeah. So I know just recently, actually, University of Oregon voted to divest from fossil fuels. We've seen several of the California schools divest from fossil fuels. And I'm blanking on the names now. There are several colleges on the East Coast that from 2010 to now, over that span of time, have voted to divest. So a lot of colleges, even before we've had the crisis of Keystone XL being greenlighted, DAPL being greenlighted, knew that climate change was enough of a crisis to divest. And in large part, these are schools with even bigger endowments than we have. We have a $2 billion endowment, but some of these schools have over $5 billion, $10 billion in their endowment, which means they're moving even more money around in the political economy when they make a decision to divest.
Right.
So it's certainly something that's feasible, and it's something you can do and still run a college really successfully.
So there will be news coming out of Grinnell later this week when President Raynard Kington makes his announcement about this issue. He has promised to make some kind of announcement, and you're looking forward to that. Your reasons for leaving now on Monday morning instead of just staying there, you know, until that announcement is made or until, you know, you get full divestment. Why are you leaving this morning?
Yeah, so this week's announcement, right, isn't going to be the full win of our campaign. And we're in it for the long haul to get victory at this campaign. So we want to take smart, calculated risks. And part of what that means is not burning our members who are willing to take risks out. So we have students who have class at 8 a.m. And if we ask students to keep missing class, then they're not going to be able to come back next month to the fight again. So part of being this in the long haul is having a clear long-term vision. And that's something that we want the administration to know that we really have is we have months down the road mapped out of where we plan to do a direct action next, how we plan to pull it off, who's going to be there, who's going to run it. And we are going to keep coming back with more and more escalated civil disobedience. So we want to make sure our members are well rested, that our members are able to do well in their classes, so that they can continue to give the type of dedication to this fight that we need to win it. So we're ending today because we think this direct action, this civil disobedience, served its purpose. It built tension on campus at a time the trustees were here. It got our president to negotiate with us to give us a couple concessions. It radicalized our base. It showed us that direct action gets the goods. And so we're happy with what we won this weekend. So we're going to go back home. We're going to rest. We're going to talk to our base, and we're going to come back even harder in a couple of weeks or a month.
Okay. Are you going to class today?
I am, yeah.
What classes do you have?
So I have macroeconomic analysis, and then I have calculus 1, which I am not looking forward to. And then I have MLK and Gandhi, which is actually taught by a professor here who supports us in our fight for fossil fuel divestment. So I enjoy that class. We really just get around and we talk about organizing theory and a lot of how it relates to our day-to-day practices.
Wow. Well, it sounds like you're combining praxis and theory.
Theory, yeah.
In your studies. Thank you very much, Ross. Maybe we'll talk to you again sometime soon.
All right. Sounds good. Thank you so much. This has been wonderful.
Sure. Bye. And that movement will be something for us all to watch as it proceeds at Grinnell College. Over the weekend, here in Ames, large audiences enjoyed the comedy and song of KHOI's own Tom and Doug. The perpetrators of the Tom and Doug Show, which airs every Saturday morning at 11:30 and Monday night at 8:30. Among the massive new hits they unveiled at the show, Laugh Out Loud, was this number, composed and performed by Tom Florek, which will serve to introduce our next guest, Sue Dinsdale of the Iowa Citizen Action Network.
So, Tom, do you have an opinion about the person who's up for Secretary of Education?
Why, I might. Let me sing it to you.
Would you please?
Your kids are young, their future's clear. Their public schooling will disappear. It's demonic, it's demeaning, it's divorcee. I understand her well-known hate
for people choosing to educate. It's demonic, it's demeaning, it's divorcy, setting schools up to crash so she can then open charters for cash under trained, underpaid staff, the new status quo. And it moves the dough. She'll use her ties to legalize robbing your taxes to privatize. It's demonic, it's demeaning, it's detestable, it's destructible, it's debasing, it's degrading, it's deranged, it's divorcy. It's demonic, it's demeaning, it's divorcy.
And welcome back to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we have live in the studio Sue Dinsdale of the Iowa Citizen Action Network with several announcements, one of them relating to this character just eulogized by Tom Florek. Well, welcome, Sue.
Well, thank you for having me.
So let's talk about this Betsy DeVos. Who is she, and is she really as bad as Tom's juvenile humor would lead us to believe?
Well, I guess I didn't hear all of Tom's juvenile humor, but I do believe that she would be bad for education in our nation.
Okay, and why?
Well, first of all, I come from a family of teachers. My grandmother was a teacher. My husband, my son is a current teacher. And I know that my husband and son are definitely against having her as the head of the Department of Education. She's never gone to a public school, never taught in a public school. Maybe she's driven by one, but as far as her qualifications, I just cannot see where she is qualified to lead the department. That's, you know, it's there for our future. Education of our children is the future of our nation. And so it's a very important appointment.
And she's been a strong advocate of voucher systems and charter schools, private schools, being financed by public school money.
Right. And I don't see where that helps children like around here. You know, we don't have that many private schools or charter schools. You know, the education is a foundation of our country, and we need to invest in our public schools and make sure that our students are learning and having the funding and the support they need.
So what kind of action are you promoting right now to in relation to Betsy DeVos, the Iowa Citizen Action Network?
What we're hearing, and, you know, if it's fake news or alternative facts or maybe polls are wrong, but what we're hearing is we're one Senate vote away from blocking her confirmation. And so what we're encouraging people to do is to call Senator Ernst and Senator Grassley here in Iowa and let them know how we feel, that we do not support her.
So two Republican senators have already announced that they will not be voting for her.
Correct.
That would be Susan Collins of Maine and Senator Murkowski, I think.
I believe that's right, yes.
Alaska, maybe.
Right.
So is there any knowledge about where Grassley and Ernst stand?
You know, I can't really speak to that. We've heard rumors, especially about Senator Ernst. But what I do know is that in Iowa, our senators are supposed to be responsive to the people that they represent. And I think in the past that's been true. I hope it continues to be that way.
Okay. And I've certainly heard Herman Kurmbach talk about this issue,
right,
that vouchers would really maybe gut the school funding of rural schools that,
right,
would then be forced to consolidate. So we'll have some information on our website.
Okay.
Do you have a page where you tell people the message that you want?
I can put it up on our website. We actually, it's on our Facebook page right
okay.
now. We do have an email listserv. Of right now, it's between 6,000 and 7,000 people that we email to. And I did send that out Saturday morning and received so many responses, which is really encouraging to me that so many people have just taken the time to click back and say that they did call in, because I didn't even ask for that.
Now, I even saw over the weekend that there are some websites that are paying people to make an email or click something that would send a message to their senators to vote for Betsy DeVos.
Yes, I have seen advertisements on television also, which tells me that there is, you know, we're not sure about this nomination.
Right. It's in play. Well, education here at the state level is also a huge issue.
Huge issue.
We've got the Senate last week voted for just a 1.1% allowable growth increase, really the very minimum that would be acceptable to anybody.
I don't think it's acceptable.
And word is that the Iowa House may vote on this today.
Today, yes. And I think that is what we're hearing. So
what are folks doing in by way of, you know, making the case that Iowa schools need more than just a 1.1% increase?
Well, I think you can even look at our governor, who suggested at least a 2% increase, and the Senate really gutted that. So today there is a public hearing. It's at the Capitol at 11 a.m. I believe people are getting together a little before that, and I will be there too, just to hear and see what people are saying, and hopefully we can sway some of our House members' minds.
Okay, and you know, all of this is in the context of our shrinking budget that has been shrinking since 2013,
mm-hmm.
With a lot of corporate tax cuts. There was an article in the Omaha World Herald saying, you know, that these corporate tax cuts of 2013 are the source of Iowa's economic woes. That was the headline.
And they really are. And what we have to realize is if we don't educate our children to become workers in the future, these corporations aren't going to have anybody to work for them that has a good public education.
I have a friend from Iowa City who's going to be at that hearing, and I just want to read some things of what she posted, what her testimony is going to be at that hearing today at 11 o'clock, mm-hmm. down in the State House. She says, "Here is what overcrowded classrooms mean for my family. My husband is a high school English teacher with 22 years of experience in the classroom. He was born to teach. It's his calling and passion. He's particularly gifted at reaching students who are on the margins, who come from difficult backgrounds and considered at risk. As his class sizes have grown over the years, and particularly this year, I've begun to see the light in his eyes dim. The hours grading papers for as many as 35 students per class are long for an English teacher. Other teachers at his school have as many as 45 students in his class. He and his colleagues are tired and stressed. The workload is affecting my husband's health and our family life, and ultimately it will affect the quality of education his students will receive."
And I saw that also with my husband. My son is in, I think it's his fourth year of teaching now, and my husband and son both taught, my husband was an high school art teacher at Valley High School in West Des Moines. And my son teaches industrial tech in Olwine. Now, both of those classes aren't necessarily considered classes that kids have to have, but sometimes it's those classes that keep kids in school and keep them engaged. And in my son's case, they're building a house from the ground up. And so it's teaching them a trade that they can go on to use in their later life. So what happens with cuts? They lose good people.
Right. And, of course, it's not a cut. It's just a very, very small increase that doesn't keep up with the needs and demands of.
So it turns into a cut because then they can't afford to buy the books or the tools or the things they need. So what it is, it does cut into the education of the children.
Okay. So that is today at 11 o'clock.
Right.
Folks who are going to be speaking on the need for better funding for education in Iowa. It's been several years now of just these 1% or so increases.
It should be a priority. It should be a priority for our country and for our state.
Okay. And now you have some news about another initiative for.
Right. We are very concerned about the talk of what's coming in the realm of collective bargaining. I work closely with folks in the labor community. I'm a union member. My husband was. My son is. And our representative here in part of Story County is the head of the labor committee.
Dave Dio.
And
Republican?
Correct.
So.
And I was at the Capitol last week and heard, saw probably 100 to 150 people crowd into a small room to hear about what the effects of changing, cutting, gutting collective bargaining means. And I had the opportunity to talk to Mr. Dio afterwards. And what I asked him was why he wasn't bringing people from labor to the table before writing the bill. His answer was basically that he pretty much knew where these labor folks stood from. Actually, he mentioned the Iowa Federation of Labor and AFSCME, and he didn't need to talk to them. And I told him that that was disappointing to me, because why not have them at, you know, at least meet with them to talk about what this bill means to people. And I reminded him that we'd had some pretty bad weather. And, you know, it's not been a terrible winter, but I bet that he's been able to drive on our roads from his home to Des Moines to the Capitol. And that was thanks to a public worker. You know, that the people that teach our children are public workers. The people that are managing and doing things at the Capitol are public workers. And those are the people that are going to be hurt by this.
Well, Dave Dio held a public forum in Story City this weekend. KHOI was there to record it. And so I produced a clip of his discussion of the labor bill. So let's listen to that.
Sure.
And get your response.
One of the things that one of the concerns has been we're going to get rid of collective bargaining and get rid of Chapter 20. We're not doing that. The bill will actually keep the same framework in place that we currently have. Currently, the right to organize, the right to bargain, the bargaining process where both sides come to the table. They basically work closer and closer to an agreement, and then they, in the end, if they can't agree to something, then they go to binding arbitration. That will all still be in Iowa law. It will be in this bill. There will be some changes to some things within the scope. There'll be some changes to the arbitration rules, but as far as the as far as how the general process works now, it's still going to work the same basically as it does now. So I've had so many different concerns, and I'm hearing from both sides. I literally hundreds and hundreds of emails and letters and phone calls, as you can imagine, primarily from those opposed. So I've talked to lots and lots of people about things that they're concerned about, and wanted to address a couple of other things that you kind of alluded to. One thing that I'm hearing a lot from union members is that they like their retirement, they like IPERS. They're concerned maybe they've got to retire in a few years and they don't want anything to happen to IPERS. And what I'm assuring them of is that IPERS has never been a part of collective bargaining. It's a prohibited topic. And therefore, you know, it's been basically protected from collective bargaining for many years, and that's going to continue. With regard to the health care issue, since you mentioned that, and I'm glad you brought it up, because it's a legitimate concern that people have, that if health care is not a part of bargaining, then what's going to happen? And I quite honestly agree with some of the concerns that Governor Branstad hasn't been exactly all that open about what he's planning to do. I talked to him last week, and I challenged him to come out with some kind of a statement to make it clear. He assured me that his intention of this statewide pool that he's looking at is that it would be an opt-in or opt-out. It would not be mandatory for everybody to be a part of. And I would like to see him come out with some kind of a statement so that it's clear to people that that's what he's thinking. Because I think there is a concern that if we do a statewide plan and we tell every school, every city, you know, every public hospital, whoever it is, that you have to join this pool, you have no option, then I have a concern with that, because there's different areas of the state that have different concerns. You've got people in northern Iowa that want to be able to go to Rochester. You know, the western part of the state, they may want to go to Omaha or Sioux Falls or, you know, you name it. We've got school districts, cities that have the self-insure, you know, and if it's working for them, why not let them keep doing it? I 100% agree with that. Then this bill is not going to address a lot of that stuff. It's primarily just going to mostly allow for the ability to be able to, if they found that the pool, like a large state pool, is advantageous and it's a better deal for them, they can get in. Like if it's a small school district and they have high costs because it's a very small district, it would allow them to get into a bigger pool if they saw it as an advantage. And I want to keep that as some flexibility so our local elected officials, you know, city councils, school boards, and those folks can actually have the option to be able to make that choice and find the best plan.
And that was Dave Dio, a Republican chair of the Iowa House Labor Committee, talking about a new labor law that's going to be coming down the pike. Sue Dinsdale, Iowa Students Action Network, does Dave's words reassure you at all?
I find them encouraging. They seem a little more amenable than last week when I spoke to him. And I'm hoping that means that enough people are talking to him and that he's listening to them, that he will go about this in a comprehensive way and sit down with labor.
And labor has a rally tomorrow.
Right. Tomorrow at 10:30 at the state capitol, we will be rallying in support of strong collective bargaining laws.
Okay. So another rally. Des Moines a busy place right about
now. Iowa's a busy place right now. I was in Cedar Falls yesterday.
Okay, so you've been at this a long time, Sue Dinsdale,
right.
And so has your organization.
Yes.
How many years?
Almost 40 years.
40 years.
And we're really excited that this year on March 4th, we're having Martin O'Malley come and speak to us at our annual event. So,
neat.
And we're honoring the four members of the four boards of supervisors who voted yes on raising the minimum wage.
Ah, okay. And so that is Sue Dinsdale of Iowa Citizens Action Network. There's a lot of new players in the game. Pantsuit Nation became Action Iowa, and they're rallying and creating a lot of youthful energy. It must be interesting.
It's so wonderful. Yes.
Yeah. To interact
some of
with
us
them.
Old people get tired.
Okay, but we need your experience as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I've been your host, Greta Anderson. We started the show with wildlife correspondent Pat Schlarbaum, bringing us Jeff Kapaska of the Iowa DNR and Fisheries Program, Michael Metz of the Isaac Walton League and Story County Conservation, and Hank Kohler, recipient of this year's Olaf Smeadle Conservation Award. Ole was a columnist for the Ames Tribune who, kind of like our own Pat Schlarbaum, kept the public connected to the great outdoors. Then Ursula Rudenberg brought us Ross at Grinnell College, who has been staging a sit-in this weekend outside the president's office in the administration building in an effort to move forward divestment of the endowment fund from the fossil fuel industry. Finally, Sue Dinsdale of Iowa Citizen Action Network told folks of three critical actions her group is promoting: calling our senators in Washington to reject the nomination of Betsy DeVos, heading on down to Des Moines this morning for an open public hearing on education in the House chambers, and finally a labor rally to be held tomorrow in the face of changes that are certain to happen but uncertain about exactly what they'll be, to Chapter 20, the part of the Iowa Code establishing the rules for bargaining between government entities and their employees. Local Talk will be rebroadcast at noon and 7 p.m. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoyfm.org. That's khoyfm.org. There you will also find information about our guests, along with today's links relevant to today's stories. Thanks to Ron Carson for making that possible. Local Talk was engineered by myself, Greta Anderson. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was DeVossi, a new song and dance number by Tom Florek of The Tom and Doug Show. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878. That's 292-2878. Or contact us through our website, khoyfm.org. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.
KHOI is funded in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. Find job opportunities throughout Ames and Story County at workinames.com. Again, that's workinames.com.